own feelings validated by someone like him. Before we started working with Rick, the guys at Q Prime decided to send us on an under-the-radar mini-tour of out-of-the-way places in California, just to get the road rust off. We played on a makeshift stage behind some guy's house in Chino, in the old town hall in Fresno, and at some rodeo bar in Reno. We didn't even sell out the venues till we reached Santa Barbara. I remember thinking, sometimes you're riding high in April and shot down in June, but at least we have each other. We were full of enthusiasm and color, and you could sense that something was brewing that could be amazing, but we weren't quite there yet. That summer, I was still living under Guy O'Siri's roof, commuting every day to Flea's garage. Sometime that August, out of the blue, I decided to go get loaded again. I hadn't slipped since Hawaii, so I'd been clean for 6 months. But one day, I just got on my motorcycle, headed downtown, and did the whole thing. It made no sense, and I didn't enjoy it, but I'd reawakened the 800-pound gorilla. I found myself in a hotel room, and when I woke up, I knew I couldn't mention this to anyone. It was a weekend, and I got my shit back together and went to rehearsal all the next week. I went out again that weekend, only this time I couldn't turn it off so easily. I ended up in a hotel in San Diego, of all places, depressed again. I didn't know what to do. I didn't even have the strength to leave, when I heard a knock on the door. Who the fuck could that be? I went to the peephole and looked out, and there were John and Flea and Chad. I opened the door, and they walked in.
"I'm really sorry," I said.
"Don't even worry about it," Flea said. "You fucked up. Let's just go home and get back to work."
He was so matter-of-fact and non-judgmental about it.
"Oh, man, I'm so sorry you had to experience that," John said. "It must have sucked, but you can't do this anymore."
We piled into Flea's multicolored Mercedes clown car, which exacerbated the absurdity of my surroundings, and drove north to L.A. They were telling me that we had a record to make, but they were really easygoing about it, so that took a lot of weight off my shoulders. We stopped to eat some Mexican food, and by then we were laughing and throwing food around and having a good time. When we got back to L.A., Flea offered to let me stay at his house, in this big octagon-shaped downstairs bedroom suite with leopard print carpeting. I moved in, and it was a really peaceful and productive two-month stay. All I did was read and write and go to band practice and hang out with Clara and Flea and the dogs. I got rid of all the extraneous complications of nightlife and girls and partying, and just stayed in the compound and got a lot of work done. One day while I was at Flea's, on a whim, I decided to cut off all my hair. I'd had my tailbone-length hair for 13 years, but I didn't think twice about going to my friend and getting that shit shorn. I did save the hair and send it off to my dad in Michigan. He and I had had a hair solidarity thing since the early 70s. The night of my haircut, I got home late, and Flea was already asleep. The next morning, I strolled into the kitchen in my PJs. Flea did the all-time eyes-bugged-out double take, then started laughing hysterically.
"Oh my God! I'm back at Fairfax High again, and we're 16 years old! Look at you!"
By this point, we'd made the transition from Flea's garage to a rehearsal studio named the Swing House on Cahuenga. Rick Rubin started coming by and lying on the couch and listening to us play, taking a few notes here and there. We started amassing a rather enormous quantity of raw material, in terms of pieces and parts, and songs and half-songs and bridges and choruses and verses and intros and outros and breakdowns. Again, we set up a chalkboard of these ideas. Things were going so well with the album that in the middle of October, Guy O and I decided to take a trip to New York. We went to lunch at Balthazar in Soho with two other friends, and as we were being seated, I noticed that this girl who worked there shot me a glance. I was very single then, and very open to the universe introducing me to a friend, and this girl zapped me with one look. We were sitting at the table, and the other guys were looking at every skirt that walked by, but I was still fixated on that blonde. The next thing I knew, this girl, who wasn't our waitress, came strutting by our table with a real Miss Sassy Pants attitude. "That's the one I'm talking about," I told the others, but they couldn't have cared less. The food arrived, but I had to go talk to this girl. I sauntered over to the hostess podium, stepped in front of her, and said, "Hello, my name's Anthony." I was 5 seconds into the conversation when a guy from the next table, whom I'd met once in a rehab when he came to visit his brother, took the opportunity to hug me and tell me everything that he'd been up to in the last few years. Meanwhile, my gal was getting away. "Dude, do me a favor, be quiet and go sit down right now. I'll come over in a little bit," I said. Finally, he left. "What are you doing after work?" I asked the girl. "Not coming to visit you," she said. "How about tomorrow after work?" I countered. She agreed. The rest of that day, I was very excited. I tuned the rest of the female race out of my consciousness. I was just smitten. That night, Guy-O wanted to go out and meet girls, but I shrugged. "Nope, can't do it. I met one," I said. So the rest of his trip was basically ruined, because now I was monogamous. The bad news was that I was leaving in 2 days, so I only had 1 day to make something happen with this girl. I met her after work, and we walked over to have sushi at a nearby restaurant. I really liked Johanna. She had crystal blue eyes, looked like a magical fairy, was exactly my height, and had a real strong sense of self. Plus, she had mad style and was tough and a little crazy. When I looked in her eyes, I saw an invisible spirit of something that I already loved. This girl could be my girlfriend, I decided. We had some sushi, and she drank some alcohol, and it didn't faze me. Then we smoked some cigarettes and walked around Soho. I tried to subtly suggest that she might spend the night in my hotel room. "Well, I might, but I'm not going to fuck you or anything like that," Johanna said. That was fine with me, and we started heading back. But we stopped under a streetlight and started kissing. The kiss was definitely working. It wasn't a horny lust kiss. It was a real human connection kiss, and she was a good kisser. In my room, we talked and talked for hours, getting to know each other. I read her some things from my book of lyrics, including a dense song called Quixotic Elixir. We listened to music and had a lot of physical contact. There was nudity and touching. But she hadn't been kidding when she said she wouldn't fuck me. In fact, she made it clear that if we continued, she wanted to see an AIDS test from me. All of this was making me feel better, because who wanted to fall in love with a girl who was ready to sleep with anyone who came along? Another positive was that she wasn't a fan of my band. She was 23 years old from upstate New York and had been a straight upstate New York raver bitch on ecstasy in her youth. I went home the next morning. I moved back to Guy-O's house and was talking to Johanna on the phone at least 3 times a day. The guy started organizing my 36th birthday party, and the day before, he asked me if I wanted any girls there. I told him that apart from Sherry and my friend Mary Forsberg, I just wanted my male friends and the guys in the band. "Are you sure? I can invite a bunch of hot girls," he prodded. "The only girl I'm interested in is Johanna. I think I'd rather get on a plane and fly to New York for the day than have the party," I said. "Why do they have to meet a girl who's a million miles away?" November 1 rolled around, and we convened at a fancy-pants place down on Beverly. There was a bunch of tables pushed together, and it was a festive atmosphere. I was trying to make the best of a birthday occasion, feeling good because I had been back to being sober for a few months. The dinner was going on, and I was chatting and eating, and then I looked over at Guy, who had a really weird expression on his face. When I turned my head to the right, I saw Johanna walking into the restaurant with Guy's assistant. Unbeknownst to me, Guy had flown her in for the weekend. Johanna was all dressed up in a sharp outfit, with her New York fur jacket and her blonde hair and her blue eyes and the lipstick and eye makeup and her big bright smile. And Chad, Mr. Class, turned to Guy and whispered, "What, did you get him a hooker?" The first thing I did was grab her by the hand and take her to her table in the back. I felt that we needed a few minutes alone to make a connection without being scrutinized by everyone at the table. As soon as the dinner was over, I took her back to Guy-O's house, packed a bag, and we got a room at the Chateau Marmont, where I'd live for the next few months while we were recording our album. We spent a really nice night. Johanna drank a bottle of red wine and took a bath, and I snapped some pretty pictures of her in the tub, the pale green water contrasting nicely with her pale white skin. But we had no biblical relations. If I'd known Guy was flying her out, I would have had the results of that AIDS test right there on the dresser. She stayed for 2 days, and we were joined at the hip for the whole time, getting to know each other better. She left, and I went back to work writing songs. I was absolutely into this girl, and a lot of my writing was beginning to get influenced by that fact. I had a whole new well of feelings to tap into. But the more I'd gotten to know her, the more I realized that she was a troubled girl herself, who was maintaining a calm, cool, and collected front around me. It became evident when she came out in December to visit me. Even though I was still sober, I wasn't working at getting well. I wasn't working through the 12 steps or even going to many meetings. I was what they call a dry drunk, someone who's irritable and restless and discontented, and even though technically sober, is suffering from the same crippling character defects of an alcoholic. I was still an obsessive, self-centered, selfish control freak, instead of living my life instinctively in the way of love and service. If I had been working on my sobriety, I would have been doing a lot of personal writing, which helps you recognize your behavior and start taking action so you don't repeat it. I was too busy writing songs and rehearsing and recording to put in that work, which was a cop-out. The only way the program will work is if you put your sobriety first, and then everything else in your life will fall into place. I was a little rough around the edges, a little bit uncomfortable in my own skin, even though I was getting a lot of band work done. And here came this girl I liked a little bit too much. So I was a little overbearing and insecure about the relationship instead of just letting it be. I was trying to manipulate it a little too much, and it started to get tense. The first mistake I made on her visit was to drag her out to this Hollywood schmooze fest called The Fire and Ice Ball. It was a fashion show in a rented space filled with movie stars and fabulousness. Not the best place to take a girl you don't know that well. It was uncomfortable, it was awkward, it was Hollywood at its silliest. Not a great date. We double-dated with Guy O. The minute we got in the limo, Johanna started rummaging through the booze collection and throwing back shots of vodka. She's nervous, I thought. She doesn't know these people and she wants to loosen up. But I did notice that she wasn't sipping these drinks. We went into the party and I was just not relaxed. Guys were flirting with her and I was getting jealous and not feeling good about anything. So we started to drift apart. And we ended up leaving and going to a smaller party with Madonna and a bunch of actors on the top floor of a tall building on Sunset. Now Johanna started ordering triple cosmopolitans, downing them one after another. By then she'd stopped talking to me because she thought I was being an asshole. As she was guzzling these drinks, I thought this was definitely not going to work. I got up and started walking around the party. When I looked back at the table, she was gone. Then I looked across the room, and there was Jack Nicholson sitting on a chair with Johanna on his knee. They were passing a joint back and forth. That was not a pleasant sight at all. Meanwhile, chaos had broken out around me, and I was summoned to help this girl who thought she was having a heart attack from doing too much coke. I told her to just go home and sleep it off, and she'd be fine. Then I ran into the model who'd been making out with Jamie the night I met her in New York. The girl started rubbing up against me, and I thought, okay, this might work. Two can play at this game. We got on the couch, and within minutes, the girl said, "Can I come back to your hotel, or do you want to come back to my house?" "Let's go to your house," I said. Even as the words came out of my mouth, my heart was dying a million deaths. I looked over and saw Johanna sitting on the floor with a very drunk Joaquin Phoenix. This was going from bad to worse. Seconds later, Joaquin came over to me.
"I'm having a hard time getting a handle on what's up with this girl," he said. "I keep asking her if she wants to get out of here, and all she can say is, 'I came here with Anthony,' yet you're clearly on your way to another scenario. I just want to know where things are."
"She's a big girl. She can make her own decisions," I said. "Whatever she wants, welcome to it. I've got nothing to do with her anymore." It turned into a Mexican standoff. I didn't want to leave with that other girl, and Johanna didn't really want to leave with someone else. She'd also arrived at the point where she couldn't walk anymore. So I picked her up and threw her over my shoulder and got her in a car. I was ready to have this big talk with her, but I looked over and she had passed out cold. I had to carry her into the hotel room. I laid her down on the couch and closed the curtains and she passed out like a baby. Meanwhile, I had been through an emotional meat slicer. I lay down in my bed, but it was no rest for the tortured mind. I was up all night with visions of Jack Nicholson smoking a doobie with my girlfriend. Ugh. She woke up feeling a lot more refreshed than I did. We had a talk and realized that we were both being idiots, that the night had been a mutual display of vulgar immaturity. That week showed me that nothing short of a small atomic blast could have derailed our relationship, because if we could get through that first night of her blacking out and me being a creep, we had proved our ability to weather a storm right off the bat. The band began recording the album, and the sessions were going well when we took a Christmas break. I went home to Michigan, and then back to L.A. On New Year's Eve 1999, Flea, John, and I went to the Playboy Mansion for their party. It wasn't really our scene. It was tacky being in the land of a million fake tits. We weren't into the Charlie Sheen, Fred Durst thing at that stage of our career.
Plus, I was missing Yo. We had planned to be on the phone for the dawning of the new year, but when I called, something in her voice sounded amiss. She was out on a ferry boat in New York Harbor. Here was this person who'd expressed her true love to me, and I'd done likewise, so there was an obvious heart connection between us. But she wasn't all there on the phone. It was disquieting. Johanna's birthday was early in January. Since everything was going well with the recording, I decided to take a weekend trip to New York to surprise her. She was living in Brooklyn with her sister and a guy who had enough piercings in his lip to make a zipper. I took the red eye to New York and checked into the Mercer Hotel. I was so excited about this surprise that I had to keep myself from going out to Brooklyn too early. To ensure that she'd be home, I'd told her that I was having an exotic plant delivered to her place that day. Finally, I hopped in the cab and headed out to Brooklyn. The further I went, the dingier the neighborhood became. When we got to the address, it turned out that she was living in a basement apartment in a very shady neighborhood. I knocked on the door, all excited, and she answered it and was just torn up and hungover. She was not looking good or feeling good, and certainly not blossoming with joy at my surprise appearance. She let me in, grunted, and got back in bed. I jumped into bed with her. We made love, but it was very uninspired. Then we got into the shower together. I looked down and saw her arms, and my heart sank. She had crazy-ass black and blue track marks. I knew that she drank, and I knew that she had been the ex-raver girl, but I had no idea she was the coke-smoking, coke-shooting, occasional heroin chaser girl. I was devastated. Not because I was upset with her, but because I realized that this person I was so in love with was a sick drug addict, and that her poor little soul was probably doomed to a miserable life of chasing the drugs and feeling like crap. Johanna saw the look in my eyes and was saddened because she'd been found out. She assumed that no guy in his right sober mind was going to hang out with a girl who was shooting coke. I had to sit with my senses. This clear, beautiful intuition took over. I knew exactly how I felt, and I wasn't confused or clouded or compromised. I realized that none of my feelings had diminished, but I might have to lose someone I truly loved. I didn't want to run away from Johanna, but I knew drug addiction was strong enough that I had to be willing, if need be, to let go of the person I'd just fallen in love with. We went for a walk through Brooklyn and stopped to get some coffee. She was 24 years old that day, and she looked so unhealthy with sunken, bloodshot eyes and a sickly pallor. "Does this mean it's over for us?" she asked me. "I don't think so," I said. "I still love you. I don't know if it's possible for us to be together, but I'm not walking away from you because of this." I think she was touched by that. Then we went into Manhattan, and I gave her some presents. The next night, I had to fly back. When I left, I wished her luck and told her that I hoped she'd find a way to deal with her problem. I went back to work in Hollywood. Without telling me, Johanna started going to meetings and got clean. Back in the studio, things were going well, but the one song that was so important to me was less important to everybody else. That was Californication. Every time I'd bring it up, everyone would go, "We've got 25 other songs recorded. We don't need another one." "No, we have to have this," I urged. "This is the anchor of the whole record. It's as good a lyric as I've written in a long time. It has to be a song." I was not letting go. I kept telling John that we had to finish it. Meanwhile, the session was winding down, and we had only a few days of basic track recording left. In the last moments of recording, John came running into the studio with his new $30,000 White Falcon hollow-body guitar. He said, "I got it! I've got Californication!" He sat down and plucked this incredibly sparse yet haunting combination of notes. It was so different from any other approach that we'd taken for the song that I didn't quite hear it. Then he started singing it, and it was at the high end of my range, but it was doable. He taught it to Flea and Chad, and we rehearsed it a couple times and recorded it. It was such a sensation of relief and gratification to know that the song didn't end up in the same trash bin as Quixotic Elixir and a number of other songs that I had high hopes for. Californication. Psychic spies from China try to steal your mind's elation. Little girls from Sweden dream of silver screen quotations. And if you want these kind of dreams, it's Californication. It's the edge of the world and all of Western civilization. The sun may rise in the east, at least it settles in the final location. It's understood that Hollywood sells Californication. Pay your surgeon very well to break the spell of aging. Celebrity skin, is this your chin, or is that war you're waging? Firstborn unicorn, hardcore, soft porn, dream of Californication, dream of Californication. Marry me, girl, be my fairy to the world, be my very own constellation. A teenage bride with a baby inside, getting high on information, and buy me a star on the boulevard, it's Californication. Space may be the final frontier, but it's made in a Hollywood basement. Cobain, can you hear the spheres singing songs off station to station? And Alderaan's not far away. It's Californication. Born and raised by those who praise control of population, everybody's been there, and I don't mean on vacation. Firstborn unicorn, hardcore soft porn. Dream of Californication, dream of Californication. Destruction leads to a very rough road, but it also breeds creation. And earthquakes are to a girl's guitar, they're just another good vibration. And tidal waves couldn't save the world from Californication. Pay your surgeon very well to break the spell of aging. Sicker than the rest, there's no test, but this is what you're craving. Firstborn unicorn, hardcore soft porn, dream of Californication, dream of Californication. One of the reasons I was able to sing Californication with little trouble was that I'd been taking vocal lessons with an amazing teacher named Ron Anderson. Over the years, I tried a number of vocal coaches. Before Mother's Milk, I took lessons from a white-haired crazy lady from Austria, whose claim to fame was that she had worked with Axl Rose before Appetite for Destruction. Her whole thing was to stand in one place and press your belly a certain way, which didn't resonate with me, since I was ragdolling all over the stage. Around Blood Sugar, I took some lessons with Michael Jackson's vocal coach, but I didn't like him much and bailed out after two sessions. For one hot minute, I took lessons with a pleasant fellow who played piano and sang in bars for tips. I don't know if I improved my vocalizing abilities, but it was a lot of fun. Instead of doing scales, we'd get out one of his hundreds of songbooks and sing Beatles songs. Then I found Ron Anderson, who was a classical teacher possessed of an operatic voice. It wasn't fun to sit there and sing scales, but I could feel immediate results and had much more control over my voice. I worked with him every day during the recording of the album, which we ultimately called Californication. My biggest mistake was not to continue working in his style, so I'd lose my voice a lot when I was out on the road. It reached a breaking point while we were on tour in New York. Ron flew out and worked with me all day, and I was well enough to make the gig. He gave me a strict regimen of warming up my voice, which I do religiously to this day. We were all thrilled when we finished work on the album. We felt like a forest that had been burned to the ground and then new trees had sprouted from the ashes. Flea was still in his emotional ringer, but John and I, and even Chad, had been through our own ringers, so there was a real bond between us, and seeing this project through was a real unifying process. Having gone through it all had changed our outlooks. You can't be as much of a bitch as you were before. You can't be as much of an egomaniac. You can't feel as much like the world owed you something. You can't be the where's mine guy. The where's mine was that I was alive and getting the opportunity to play music with the people I most like to play music with. One of the most mystifying aspects of this era of our band was that we were as enthusiastic as we were when we started, if not more so. And when we started, we had cornered the market on enthusiasm. We mixed the record and people started coming by to hear it, and we were over the moon with the reactions. Things were going well on the home front too. I was going back and forth to New York to visit Johanna, who is now the sober girl. She wanted to go back to school, so I set her up at the Fashion Institute of Technology, and she was doing well. The light in her eyes was back, and we were getting along spectacularly. The only snafu the band ran into was when we played the finished album for our new management team. Cliff and Peter flew to LA, sat in the studio, listened, and were so unimpressed we couldn't believe it. We played them Scar Tissue and Other Side and Californication, and they sat there saying, "Okay, we might be able to work with that one. I don't know about the other one. It's not a home run, but we might be able to get on base with that." They're still like that. They still underreact to things. We found it almost humorous that they were receiving the fruits of our labor with such a low-key reaction. We weren't worried about it. We believed in the record, and we loved it and wanted to share it. But we weren't anticipating its reception so much as we were just pleased with what we made. Cliff decided that we should lead with Scar Tissue as the single and the first video. We decided to do a special small tour to unveil the album. Since it was being released in June, my friend Chris Rock suggested we play proms around the country to promote it. That got me thinking about my high school days and how exciting it was to turn out to see bands that came through, so we decided to do a bunch of free shows for high school students. Then Columbine happened, and a firestorm of fear swept over all these high schools. We felt it was more important than ever to do the shows, so we came up with the idea of having high school students write essays on how they could make their schools better, safer, happier, more rocking places, so they didn't have to go to school afraid. If you wrote the essay, you got a free ticket to the show. We went out in May and played, and it was an absolutely magical grouping of shows, because they were small and for kids who clearly wanted to be there, who had taken the time to write the compositions. There was so much love coming off these kids, we couldn't have asked for a better reception. We knew that the album was connecting with a lot of people when we went on a European press tour in June. We were in Italy, and John and I were riding in the back of a Mercedes with the window open. A scooter with two Italian guys on it pulled up next to us. They looked inside the car and started screaming, "Hey, Californication! Californication!" then started singing Scar Tissue. The record had been out for 5 days. Everywhere we went, every shop was playing our record. Italy had caught fire. We went from selling a handful of records to selling more records than anyone that year in Italy. How does an entire country decide to start loving you in one day? In July, we began a series of huge shows. In the short amount of time since our record came out, there had been a huge buzz all over the world. The record was getting received in a much larger and warmer way than we ever expected. Somewhere along the way, we were asked to close Woodstock 99. That was perfect, because we had been asked to play an outdoor show on Yonge Street in Toronto the day before. It was supposed to be a low-key show, but the whole town turned out. This massive expanse of humanity filled the street and every building and rooftop. It was another indicator that the world was with us, and that we had reawakened the sleeping Red Hot fans from their Rip Van Winklesome. They all came out of the woodwork to rock with us for this record. The next day we went to Woodstock. We planned to fly in, get on a bus, get to the venue an hour before our set, get focused, play, and get the hell out of Dodge before the mass exodus began. Before we got there, we'd heard reports that this event was less organized and the crowds were getting out of control. When we pulled onto this old military base way up in upstate New York, it was clear that this situation had nothing to do with Woodstock anymore. It wasn't symbolic of peace and love, but of greed and cashing in. The little dove with the flower in its mouth was saying, "How much can we overcharge the kids for this t-shirt and get away with it?" We got backstage and were all hell-bent on getting straight into our rituals. The physical warm-ups, the stretching, the meditating, the finger exercises, the vocal warm-ups. It was about 7, so we would be taking the stage during an explosive and dramatic upstate New York sunset. We hadn't heard any reports about people getting abused or raped or anything like that. It just seemed to us like another big rock festival, with no particularly evil elements about it. Our sacred hour of preparation was interrupted when Jimi Hendrix's sister came backstage and pleaded with us to do a song by her brother. It seemed that an all-star Hendrix tribute had fallen apart, and she was mortified that Woodstock would forget him. It had been a long time since we played a Hendrix song, so our first inclination was to say no. But she kept telling us how much it would mean to her, so 10 minutes before we were to go on stage, we decided to do Fire. I reviewed the lyrics, and John reacquainted himself with the chords. Right before we were due on stage, Flea came up to me and said, "I'm thinking of doing the show naked. What do you think?" "If that's what you're thinking, don't even question it. Go let your freak flag fly, brother," I said. In that setting, it seemed natural for him to be naked, and no one let it be a distraction. We played a fluid, dynamic show. As night fell, we saw this giant column of fire far back in the audience. We'd been through tons of festivals where bonfires had been started, so this one didn't seem out of the ordinary. When it was time for our encore, we started into Fire. Not because there were fires raging, but as a palliative for poor Jimmy's sister. And the old shoe fit. Then we ran off stage, drove to the plane, landed in Manhattan, and checked into our home away from home, the Mercer Hotel. It was only midnight, but we started hearing this ruckus about the riots and the rapes and the fires raging at Woodstock. That was so weird, because to us it had seemed like a normal rock and roll show. but we woke up to papers and radio stations vilifying us for inciting the crowd by playing Fire. We ignored these ridiculous charges, though it did turn out that the promoters were assholes, and it had not been a user-friendly environment. We should have paid closer attention to that and not been so isolated from the fans' point of view. I guess it was irresponsible to just show up, play, and leave without taking a closer look at some of the details surrounding the show. Now it was time to go to Europe to play. Q Prime was ideologically built on touring. Their basic philosophy was that after you put out a record, you had to crisscross the globe 10 times if you wanted it to do well. We were used to touring, but not to that degree. The longer you've been in a band and the more times you've toured, the more difficult it becomes to say, I'm going on tour for 2 years and I'm going to sleep in a different bed every night and be in buses, trains, cars, taxis, shuttling and shifting and pushing and pooling and not eating normally and not sleeping normally and not being around loved ones. Flea had a young daughter, which made it even harder. But Q Prime were very into it, and it had been a long time since we'd been there, so we were a bit more willing to hit the road incessantly than we would be in the future. We started by doing a free show in Moscow on August 14, 1999. As part of Russia's Glasnost Awakening, they'd embraced MTV, and we were tapped to inaugurate MTV's Russian debut with a huge free concert in Red Square. The first problem was that John had to be talked down from his concern that we might be kidnap victims, because next to Colombia, Russia had become the kidnap capital of the world. After getting assurances for our personal safety and getting assigned a contingent of security personnel, we agreed to do the show. You'd expect that Moscow, Russia's biggest city, would be run efficiently, maybe even in a military fashion, but that wasn't the case. There was no order at all, and shakedowns were the norm. The cops, the military, the airport personnel, everybody wanted our rubles. It was the first time any of us had been to Russia, and we did feel a little unsafe there. We stayed at the Kempinski Hotel, a 5-star gaudy, gilded, marbled oasis in the middle of a strikingly poor economy. Everything in Moscow was gray, gray, gray. The sky was gray, the buildings were gray, the streets were gray, the bushes were gray. There was this heavy cloud of Stalinesque gravity that suffocated the place. We took a couple of days to decompress and tour the city. The day before the show, by some horrible stroke of fate, I wrecked, racked, twisted, turned, sliced, and diced my back. I saw a physical therapist, but it did no good. I could see the enormous stage they had built from my hotel window, and I was bummed at the prospect of playing before all of Russia on MTV with a whack back. The day of the show, Red Square was so filled with wall-to-wall Russians that we needed a police escort to get near the stage. By the time we went on, my back was still not happening, even though it was better than the day before. Still, I was able to stand up straight and present the songs. Nothing buck wild, no ability to do my song and dance thing, but we made the best of it. Then we hightailed it out of Russia, but we got pulled over and extorted by the police on the way to the airport. As a final indignity, Chad got shaken down for all the money he had on him right before boarding. I'd never really liked Austria, mainly because the people I met there were so arrogant and pompous. But when we stepped off the plane in Vienna after a week in Russia, it was like going to Disneyland for the first time as a kid. The sun came out, the clouds opened, you could smell flowers, there was snow on the mountains, it was just heaven. However, the rest of this leg of the European tour was not my shining moment. It's difficult to keep a relationship prospering when you're in Europe and your girlfriend is in America and you're both relatively newly sober and you haven't worked through a lot of control issues and jealousy issues and insecurity issues and dependency issues. There was a lot of emotional frying going on. It was hard being gone for months at a time and so far away that the time difference became a huge obstacle. You want to communicate, but then you aren't able to and days go by. You get mad and try to call her, and you can't find her, and then you finally do catch her, and she's been out doing something stupid that she shouldn't have been doing because she should have been there waiting for your phone call, but she blew you off, and then she starts to get suspicious, and who's that girl's voice in the background? Oh, that's my masseuse or my friend or whatever. I wasn't good at it, and Johanna was no better, and together we equaled stubborn. These things always took a lot of repairing, and we'd have to wait until I got home. The band worked our asses off touring that year. Johanna finished school, and we decided it would be a good idea for her to move to L.A., which meant I'd have to get a place to live. I'd always fancied a gorgeous old building in West Hollywood called the Colonial House, which was a stone's throw from the Chateau Marmont. When Jennifer Lopez moved out of the penthouse, I grabbed it. Johanna moved to L.A. in September 1999. She had the use of my nice new Cadillac Esplanade and all her expenses paid, but she didn't have a job, and she didn't know that many people, and I was about to leave again for Europe. On the way to Europe, the band stopped in New York and did a gig at Windows on the World in the World Trade Center for K-Rock Radio Contest winners. The show was lively and energetic, but the sound system was horrific. All I heard were drums and guitar and no vocals for the entire show. I ended up screaming my lungs out and losing my voice, which was a drag. We flew to Finland and began crisscrossing Europe. When we got to Spain, Johanna decided to come out for the last week of the tour. I loved the girl. I was happy to see her, happy to have my woman in my bed, in my arms, but she was hard to get along with on a daily basis, as was I. She never did come to a comfortable understanding that a lot of the people who were fans of the band happened to be girls, and for some reason, she held me responsible. There were times when we played shows, and I'd be with her, and we'd have to walk from the arena to wherever the car was, and frenzied people would charge me. A lot of times, they were girls, and there were crazy screamings of, "I love you! I love you! I want to be with you! Please hug me!" I have no reason to be mean to these people, or to explain to them, "I have a girlfriend. You must not approach me with such sentiments." Their interaction with me is just an illusion. I'm like, "Thank you very much. Hello. Goodbye. God bless. Enjoy the night. Carry on." If I was with Johanna, she'd say, "No, you can't let those girls come up and say those things to you. They have to know that I'm your girlfriend." Yo and I had this historical antagonism. When we were apart from each other on the road, we antagonized each other. And when we got together on the road, we antagonized each other. It was because all we wanted was each other's constant love and attention, and for no one else to receive that love and attention, which is a selfish and difficult place to be in a relationship. We were emotionally retarded, and that was the best we could do at the time. We played in Barcelona, and Chad had made friends with a Barcelonan sweet tart who was cute as a button. She came backstage, and when Chad introduced her, I stood up, gave her a European kiss greeting, and welcomed her to sit down and grab a bite to eat. This, of course, infuriated Johanna. When the girl left, I looked up and said, "Bye-bye, sweetie." "Sweetie? Did you just call her sweetie?" Johanna fumed. "Oh, so now she's your sweetie." Although she was making an ass out of herself, I was right there with her. Because the next day, it would be me saying, "Did you just say goodbye, sweetie, to that guy?" By the time we got to Madrid, the wheels had fallen off. We got into another unmemorable bickering match, like something off of I Love Lucy, but without the happy ending. We were in this beautiful hotel suite in Madrid, madly in love, out there on a fun, successful tour in the middle of Spain, and we started fighting about the dumbest thing on earth. And we brought it down the elevator, into the lobby, into the bus that was taking us to our plane. Unfortunately, that carried on throughout Lisbon. Then we went home and fought there. I loved living in this cool penthouse apartment with her, but it was never smooth sailing. We'd both been such fucking dope fiends for so long that we never had a chance to grow out of our childish behavior. We must have loved the drama and the constant rush of fighting and making up and starting the whole cycle over again. It was just crazy. I know that I had nothing but love for this girl. I had no interest in chasing any other girls. My only interests were in seeing her get well and in taking care of her, which turned out to be one of the problems. I took care of her so much that she just expected a constant, "Oh well, Anthony will do it for me." I'd pay for everything she needed. I'd try to find her a job, I'd try to find her a friend, I'd try to find her a sponsor, always doing everything for her. Once she started expecting that response, I was like, "Fuck that. Don't go expecting shit. Earn your place in life. Earn your respect. Just do your thing." So she was in a terrible place, because she probably felt resentful toward me for giving her stuff, and then thinking that she should earn her own place in life. It was a lose-lose situation, and I wasn't very good at handling it. Even when I financed her startup fashion business, that became a troubled area of contention. As soon as I saw her stuff, I thought, "These clothes are so amazing. She's got mad style." I got on the phone with my managers in New York saying, "I need the names of all the major department store buyers." But Johanna was never satisfied, never grateful, and never comfortable with it. She was always on edge and discontented about something. I was equally maladjusted to life at that point. I had been off my gyroscope for so long that I didn't know how to handle any of life's basic scenarios with any clarity or intuition. There were also some fun things happening at the time. Our sex life had started off pretty slowly, but it had developed over time into a spiritual attraction after we finally figured each other's bodies out. She had a depth to her sexuality that I had never experienced before. There was no question about our love, though we were both combustible personalities. That year, we visited both our families at Christmas. It was the first time that my parents had met her. It's funny, my male friends were always terrified of Blackie. When they met him, they'd try to shake his hand, and he'd just look at their hands and walk away. But he was never like that with my girlfriends. He was always incredibly gracious and welcoming to whatever girl I happened to have in my life. He couldn't wait to hang out with Johanna and go through the family photos with her. But Yo was not the warmest of people. Even though she might feel it on the inside, she didn't communicate any of it to anybody. That was how it was with her and my mom. My mom was very happy that I had this person I was in love with, but she could never tell if Johanna had any love or compassion for her or the rest of our family, because Yo wouldn't wear her emotions on her sleeve. I had a lot to be thankful for that Christmas. The album was continuing to sell phenomenally. Every so often I'd get a call from Gail at Q Prime, and she'd tell me, "Californication's number this in this country, and it's still in the top 10 there." I'd jump around, skipping and hooting and hollering. It's a shame that my personal life wasn't flourishing in the same way my professional life was. Professionally, we were on fire. Besides the record sales, we were playing great. We had figured out how to breathe life into these new songs that had tapped into a deeper and more haunted emotional realm than we'd ever visited before. Watching the constant evolution of John was also a movie unto itself. When we went out at the beginning of Californication, he was shy and withdrawn on stage, not going in for overt emoting. Over time, he developed into this ham bone who just couldn't get enough. "Let's start the show with me soloing for 10 minutes. He wasn't doing it out of narcissism. He was doing it out of his love for playing music and his desire to commune with the spirits, both invisible spirits and also the spirits of the people who were there to experience music and love. Watching him spread his wings was a delight. We brought in the Millennium at a concert at the Forum in our hometown. The Forum always had these great memories for us. Flea and I had sneaked into the Forum to see Queen back in the day. And more recently, when we came to Warner Brothers, we hit the jackpot as Laker fans because Mo had 4 tickets at center court on the floor. After Blood Sugar, we were the #1 perk getters at Warner's. Flea and I and 2 of our friends were always sitting pretty at center court. We'd played the Forum once with Dave Navarro, and it was one of our best American dates with him. It's always hard to do well when you're playing in your hometown. There are such high expectations, and then you have the added stress of arranging tickets for family and friends. So it can go 2 ways. Instead of doing what you do best, which is going out there and rocking, you might get too hung up on all those outside issues and wanting the show to be the best ever and end up sucking. Or you might hit the jackpot and rock your hometown like it's never been rocked before. This show was somewhere in between. We were good, but we weren't unbelievable. The nice thing was that my sister Julie and her husband Steve flew out to spend New Year's Eve with me. That was also the memorable show when John Frusciante would get shot by Cupid's arrow and fall for Mila Jovovich, who had been rehearsing her band next door to us at Swing House. That night, she came to the show wearing a wedding dress, and she put the whammy on John's flim-flammy. We had a few days off after the New Year's show, and then we went from beautiful sunny California to dismal, cold, gray Tokyo, Japan. It was the first time we played Japan since John was back in the band, and we wanted to leave a new taste in their psychic palates, since it was where John had played his last show before quitting the band. But the Japanese shows weren't much fun, and we weren't at our best. One of the problems was that by then, I had developed a chronic case of shin splints, and any time I was out on stage, moving around would be, oh, ah. After Japan, we had a week off before going to Australia and New Zealand. Everyone headed off for different holidays. I was going to meet Johanna in Bali. I couldn't wait to see her, especially after being so bummed out in Japan. I'll never forget how happy I was when I walked through that airport door and she greeted me. She had a big flower in her hair and had put on a few pounds, which I appreciated, because she looked good when her flesh was full and pushing out rather than being sucked up. We stayed at a fancy resort built into the side of a cliff overlooking the ocean. Each room was an individual unit with a stone pool. There were rose petals all over the bed and some more in the bathtub. That afternoon, Yo and I enjoyed the best lovemaking we'd ever had. Then we snorkeled and drove into the interior, which was the most beautiful part of the island. You picture Bali as this pristine, remote location, but it's really an overcrowded clusterfuck of traffic with some air pollution thrown in. There had to be a few hundred thousand people jam-packed onto the island, but the interior was solid mountains and jungle. We went on an incredible rafting adventure on a river that cut through the middle of the island. Then it was time to play Big Day Out, Australia's answer to Lollapalooza. January is the nicest time by far in Australia, because it's their summer and the whole country goes on joy time. We started our tour in Auckland, New Zealand, and we were especially excited because Nine Inch Nails were going to be on the bill with us, and we all just loved them. We were also playing with the Foo Fighters, and we would become incredibly close to them down the line. The only downside to all of this was my shin splints. Even with the week off, the pain would not subside. My shin bones were getting hairline fractures because my muscles and tendons were so swollen, they were pulling off the bone mass. Walking was painful. Jumping was even more painful. And I was going to have to go out there and give my best performances ever with these getaway sticks that were in maddening pain. 2 days before the show, I saw a doctor. "Doc, I got shin splints. Could you please give me a muscle relaxant or something that's not going to affect me from the neck up so I can perform?" I asked. He suggested Advil, but I told him I'd tried that and it hadn't worked. "There's a new non-narcotic painkiller called Ultram," he said. "It really works on athletes who have to perform under similar conditions to you. Take one in the afternoon and one right before the show." The day before the first show, I took the Ultram, and lo and behold, I started to feel pretty good. Not good enough to know for sure that I felt good, but I could swear I felt good in the subtlest possible way. It couldn't be the Ultram, because it was a non-narcotic, so I decided that I just felt good. I took the other one before the show, and man, I felt no pain in my legs at all. We played our show, and it was mad fun, 50,000 Kiwis bouncing in unison. The kids knew every word to every song, even the new ones, and it was an unbelievable rush. John was blazing on his guitar. Chad was an orchestra of cannons blasting off. Flea was a ball of primal Aborigine energy. And I felt totally in control of myself as a singer and a performer. And there was no pain. I was ready to kiss the earth. It was all good. And when we got back to the hotel, I had sex with Johanna, and something unusual happened. We were fucking and fucking, and I just was not coming. That had never been a problem. Later, it crossed my mind that it might have been due to the Ultram, but how could it make me not come? It was supposed to be a glorified Advil, a non-narcotic. It made no sense. I thought it was amazing that I could be getting pain relief from a non-narcotic pill that was also making me feel pretty nice. There had to be part of me that recognized the voice in my head saying, "Okay, you're supposed to take your Ultram at 3, and it's noon now, so maybe you should take it a little early." Halfway through the tour, I had to have my prescription refilled. But the doctor had told me it was not a narcotic, and I wasn't getting goofy high, just a foundation of artificial well-being, which I was loving. So we rocked Auckland and went on to the Gold Coast of Australia. We were the inaugural event at the Olympic Stadium in Sydney. Physically, I was in perfect health. My legs weren't bothering me. I was exercising every day, running and swimming and stretching. Johanna and I were having fantastic sex. I was loving the whole experience. But then I started to become aware of the fact that Flea was not experiencing the same euphoric joy of life and touring and music and people and skies. He was not on the same heavenly ambient wavelength. Flea had been going through a lot of personal shit with his girlfriend for this whole Californication time. I knew he was down and sick and depressed and anguished about everything, but I also knew the situation was of his own making. We create a horribly painful bouillabaisse to sit in for years on end until we can't fucking sit there anymore. But it wasn't like some evil fate flew into his ass. He created it. He sat there and masterminded his own misery. So he was troubled, but he had to appreciate that the love he was experiencing from both John and me was immense. We were backing him. We weren't dissing him. It wasn't like during the mother's milk era when John and I bonded up and left him unattached. And Flea can, at times, be a prima donna, especially earlier in the Dave era, when he was ready to quit the band at the drop of a hat. Just for the record, anything negative that I ever say about Flea is only because he's my brother, and I love him. The fact is, it's funny to take the piss out of ourselves. Each one of these guys, Flea, John, Chad, is individually a bridge to God for me, and there's nothing I would do to change any of these people or the experiences I've had with them. Every one of them has given me love and music and the best life I could ever hope to have. But at the same time, I feel compelled to laugh at all of our foibles. I'm not poking fun at the relationship to feel better about myself. It's just because we really are all such kooks. Flea was suffering then, both emotionally and physically. He was feeling zapped and sapped and run down and not centered. When we got to Melbourne, he called a band sit-down. Peter Mensch was there to tell us about our upcoming U.S. tour. And if we thought hitting Europe and the rest of the world was hard, Peter was about to tell us how many dates they were hoping to give us in the USA. I was feeling gung-ho, let's go. But Flea basically broke down and explained that he wasn't able to enjoy this experience. You could tell by the look in his eyes that he was at his wit's end. That was when he proposed the idea of touring in 3-week segments, then taking 10-day breaks between segments. It was a fairly revolutionary idea, and it made it nearly impossible to generate any money, because you have to keep your crew on salary for those 10 days. You have to keep your buses and your trucks, and it's the same amount of expenses, except for hotels, as being on tour, only you're not making a penny. We realized that doing this tour was not about making the maximum amount of money. It was about having the maximum amount of fun and enjoying and staying healthy. We implemented that schedule, and to Flea's credit, we stick to it religiously to this day. Flea came up with another important idea. For a long time, we had both been charity-oriented, and earlier, while we were on holiday at his house in Australia, he and I had talked about the idea of taking some of our profits and creating some sort of charitable organization. We decided to take 5% of our income from touring and give it away. Just give it to the best charities we could find, whether it was cancer research or children's hospitals or music programs, whatever. That's a pretty big percentage of income because half always goes towards the expenses of touring and then another 20% goes to the managers and 5% to a lawyer and another 5% to the accountants. We went to John and Chad and they both thought it was a great idea. It turned out to be an incredibly fun and positive change, because now we get the joy of helping all these people. It was shocking to the core how good it felt to be of service. Kids send us pictures of themselves and letters of gratitude and tell us how much it means to them to get some medical care or a playground or musical instruments. It was one of the best decisions we ever made as a team. But that euphoria faded back to some fairly mundane realities. In Australia, Johanna and I started fighting again. There we were, walking down the great old section of Melbourne, and we got into a tiff. It wasn't a poisonous fight. We were yelling at each other, and she was socking me, and I was grabbing her, and it was a good, healthy, working it out kind of thing. But some people walked by and thought it was a spousal abuse situation. I'm not sure who they thought was taking the worst of the abuse, but they stopped and asked if she needed help. It was a testament to the potential of our volatility. There was no physical harm, but there was an intensity about us that would have made anyone stop and say, "Is everything all right here?" I remember thinking it was fun and playful because I secretly liked it when she beat me up. She's a big, strong girl, and heaven forbid she gets her legs in the party because then you're going down. After Big Day Out, Johanna and I went back to L.A. and settled into our new digs together. We had been back a week when I was invited to the NBA All-Star Game, which was in San Francisco that year. The NBA was offering to provide us with a hotel, a car, tickets to the game, the works. Figuring we could spend a nice romantic weekend, we flew up. The hotel they put us in was not that nice of a place, but it was free and in an interesting neighborhood. Unfortunately, the game wasn't exciting, so afterward we drove back to the city and found a restaurant. We were getting along fine, sitting at an upstairs table, holding hands, and enjoying each other's company. And then we made a huge mistake. It's never a good idea for two addicts to reminisce about their old days of using drugs. When I'd met Johanna, she was drinking, but I'd never seen her on drugs, and she knew me only in sobriety. Somehow, the topics of drugs got placed on the table. "God, I can't imagine you ever doing those things. It seems so out of character for you," Johanna said. "You're so not into that self-destructive energy." Believe me, this is what I used to do, I said, and told her some of the war stories that I've recounted here. She told me some of hers, and we started realizing just what birds of a feather we were. I don't remember who suggested it first, but someone said, "Can you imagine us getting high together?" "It would be fun for a minute, but then it would be horrible," I said. "Yeah, but it would be really fun for a minute," Yo said. "It would be fun for a minute," I agreed. "What if we did it?" she said. "What if we did it just this weekend and then went home?" "That's crazy." "But it sounds interesting," I said. "Are you serious?" she asked. "I'm not really serious, but now that you mention it, I'm a little serious," I admitted. "I wasn't until you said that, and now I'm really serious," she said. "Do you want to go get high?" I asked. "Yeah, let's do it," she said. "You're sure? Because once we do this, things will never be the same," I cautioned. "Oh, we'll be all right. Let's go," she said. And we left that restaurant for our rendezvous with the 800-pound gorilla. Chapter 15. A Moment of Clarity. Johanna and I left the restaurant and went straight to Haight Street. I didn't even bother disguising myself. I just tried to stay out of the sight line of all the white kids on the street. We found a black dealer who had the coke but didn't have the heroin. We figured we'd deal with that problem later. On the way back to the hotel, we stopped in a liquor store, bought some pipes, and picked up a bottle of vodka and a bottle of cranberry juice. Johanna insisted that she wanted alcohol. If she was going out, she was going all the way out. The poor kid had no idea what she was in for. All we knew was that we were salivating like Pavlov's dogs at the prospect of getting high. Probably part of the reason I had become so interested in getting high was that Altrum was actually a heavy-duty synthetic opiate. A few months later, Louis consulted the physician's desk reference and read that under no circumstances should Ultram be administered to ex-heroin addicts because it induces a craving for opiates. I guess that idiot doctor in New Zealand didn't read his copy. Johanna and I got to the room and started smoking and smoking and drinking and drinking and, for the first time, saw each other in our getting high mode with all the quirky drug-isms that go along with that. About 5 in the morning, we ran out of coke. We were both too annihilated to go back out onto the streets, so I came up with a genius idea. I took out the yellow pages and called an escort service, knowing that the majority of those girls had drug connections. I'd pay one for her time, which would be spent in the pursuit of drugs. For once, Johanna was easygoing about my talking to another woman. The girl went off to Berkeley, and it seemed like it took her forever, but she came back with 20 Valiums, some coke, some crystal methadrine, but no heroin. We did the coke and then took the Valiums and finally crashed. Because we were in this together, it wasn't as horrible a wake-up as I'd had in the past. We were both feeling a little shaky, lying in bed wondering, what were we thinking? That was a really bad idea. So we ate and drank something, watched a movie in bed, and tried to forget about it. But then that voice came over us. "Hey, you're already fucked up. Ain't no sense stopping now." I went out and got some syringes, and we shot the speed. Of course, that wasn't enough, so Johanna scoured the streets and found a one-eyed taxi driver who sold her some smack. How horrible was that to let my girlfriend go out into the streets of San Francisco to find stuff? By now, the hotel wanted us out of our room, but when I told them we needed to stay a few more days, they moved us to a bigger room. I got on the phone and did the escort service trick again. This girl was dialed into the drug world, and she delivered everything we needed, including a bag of pure powder cocaine. My body was relatively resilient to shooting coke. It remembered stuff, like, oh yeah, this is where the heart goes into fifth gear. I started injecting large quantities and doing okay. Johanna did a smaller injection of coke, but something went drastically wrong. She'd done a million hits of cocaine in her life, but she was not doing well on this one. She lay down and got real pale and clammy, started shaking furiously, and began to have trouble breathing. She was convinced she was dying. That was the scariest moment of my drug-using career, even scarier than when I walked into Hillel's living room and saw Kim blue-faced and not breathing in his chair. I was so deeply in love with Yo that the idea of anything bad happening to her was terrifying. Before I called 911, I prayed. Okay, universe, we have a problem. The girl I'm in love with is possibly dying right here on the couch. I need a real big favor, and that is for her not to die. She had gone out like a frozen little fish popsicle on the couch, but while I was on the phone with 911, she started to breathe again, and then sat up and said she felt okay. I told 911 it was a false alarm and hung up. Then the phone rang. It was the hotel operator. "Did you just call 911?